of the Behind the Collective podcast. Now, this episode, which is part of the Livestock Collective and Australian Wool Innovation Partner Program, which the program is all about connecting and supporting WA wool growers, is actually converted over to a webinar where we had a panel of farmers talk about the value of the Merino to their businesses, their plans in the coming years, and just the ins and outs of their enterprise. We thought we'd convert it over to a podcast for easy listening, whether that's on the road, in a cab, this silly season. Alrighty. We'll get started. Firstly, thank you all for joining tonight, and especially thank you for the panel of growers we have today. I know it's a really, really busy year, and it can be scary, a scary thing discussing the intrinsic details of your business, but we appreciate you all and will no doubt all take away something and probably something different, which is a really great thing about having a panel and a few different perspectives. Firstly, a few quick introductions. My name's Tiff from the Livestock Collective, and this webinar is a part of a series of between the Livestock Collective and the Australian Wool Innovation Partner Program. We've also got Stephen Bolt and Marion, who are part of our team. And the program is about connecting and supporting WA growers. So the topics and our webinar, they're all based on feedback we've received from our survey. So when we send this webinar out, we're actually going to include a link to the survey, because this is what shapes the topics, as I say, for the podcast webinars, what events we deliver, what we attend throughout the regions. So we'd really appreciate you filling in the survey if you haven't yet, because it gives us an idea of what you want and what you need. So we'll get started, where I'll let all of the growers introduce themselves. We're going to work through some questions that I have here ready for the panel, and you can either post your questions into the chat or text them through to my number. I'll just post my number again into the chat in case it's been deleted, and I will ask those anonymously. So my first question, we'll start in what is my top left corner and Jason. So make sure our speakers take yourself all off mute, and I'm going to get you to introduce you, your business, again, who's part of your enterprise, and where your farm, where you're recording this from today.
My name's Jason Griffiths. We farm at Boxwood Hill on the south coast of Western Australia. We've got a mixed farm enterprise. We do have grain production and a self-placing merino flock, and we also do a bit of prime lamb as well. And so that's who we are and where we're from. We're a family business. We've got about 7,000 hectares, and employ a few people. That's about our business in a nutshell.
And Peter, you're next.
Sorry, I'm live now.
Yep, you're up.
I was hoping, being a W, I'd be at the end. Right. Pete Whitfield. We're farming at Conangoring, just between Gemelling and Wongan Hills. Pretty traditional mixed farming operation, with about 80% of our croppable land cropped each year, and 20% of the arable land under some form of pasture, and then all the stubbles are grazed. We run probably about, we've got 4,000 breeding ewes, and a third of those are mated to white Suffolks and two-thirds to Merino, with the Merino weather lambs being sold as trying to get them into the prime lamb market. That's us.
Awesome. Claire?
Hi, I'm a fourth generation farmer from Tenterden in the Great Southern. We're 75% crop, but then obviously the rest is made up by sheep. We have 5,500 merino ewes. 3,000 of them are mated to terminals, and then the last lot self-replacing. Yeah.
Awesome. And Simon?
Yeah, thanks, Tiff. Yeah, Simon Fowler, farming at Conningup, with my wife Robin and my brother Andrew and his wife Mari. Farming the sort of from 600 mil rainfall on the coast up to about 350 mil rainfall at Beaumont. So a good mix of livestock and cropping country. About 38,000 hectares of crop, 12,000 hectares of pasture. A couple of thousand breeding cows, about 32,000 breeding ewes, and a lamb feedlot as well. Yeah, so that's us.
Amazing. All right, so the next one, and it's a big question, is how do sheep fit into your enterprise and why? We'll start with you, Jason.
So we crop about 70% of our country farmland. Not all of our farmland is probably suitable for cropping. We've got some salt-affected areas on our farm, and we just leave those to permanent pastures with some perennial pastures or just strong annual pastures in there where we can have higher stocking rates on those paddocks. Hopefully most years because we've got a lot of grass and legume base in there. Also, we like sheep in our enterprise because we do have some – we do use it pasture as part of our rotation for nitrogen fixation and a little bit of weed control, and also just the dual income of the merino sheep with the meat and wool. So that's why sheep are important to us, yeah.
Peter?
Yeah, very similar reasons. We like the legume content up in our neck of the woods. We haven't got a lot of our home farm hasn't got a lot of good sand plane on for lupins. So yeah, we go with the subs or some other style of pasture, and just gives us a bit of diversity. Yeah, and no one really likes holidays in the summer, do they? So it's good having a few sheep. I just find that they, we're able to utilise the stubbles and maybe value add them a little. It just seems to be not a bad mix.
Claire?
Yeah, we have we've kind of been – we're very sheep dominant and then gone into cropping quite a lot, but we've still always loved the sheep in our enterprise, mainly for diversity and then using the land that isn't suitable for cropping as well as resting paddocks just if we've had a really wet year and had weed blowouts or any other reasons that they just need a good rest from being cropped.
And Simon. Oh, you're on mute there, Simon.
Is that better? Sorry about that. Similar to the other guys. I guess firstly, I'd still enjoy working with sheep, and so do my children, and so do my livestock staff. So you know that's important. And then I guess it's the role the sheep play in the whole farm system. They just make our system more sustainable and more robust and more resilient. It's the synergies as well between the livestock and the cropping. Like the other guys said, there's, you know, the stubble utilisation, crop grazing, the weed control benefits, chemical rotations, and the value adding the grain. So, you know, I think, that it's a really important role they play in the farm system and particularly in the higher rainfall parts of the farm. you know, it really is important to have livestock of some form in that rotation.
Thanks for that. All right, we'll move on to the next question. And it's plans for next year and beyond with your merinos. And then we'll go into the more specific questions for each of you. So for Jason. Oh, mute button.
We probably want to... We do a bit of, well, they call it confinement feeding. We prefer to call it pasture deferment program. We're working on that and we're looking to build on that a little bit. And we're probably really just hoping to increase our stocking rate a little bit over the coming seasons because whether that's through better pasture management or something, that's something we've got to work out. But that's really what we want to do moving forward, and just fine tune a confinement feeding or pasture deferment program. Yeah.
Hey.
No real big changes for our way we're doing things. Every time you try and grab the magic rainbow, you never quite get it. So we just sort of think we just keep chipping away at it. Probably going out of the live export weathers and maybe upping our ewe numbers slightly. Just increasing the amount of lambs we turn off. But that's a gradual thing. No real changes, really.
Yeah, we'll still aim to be mating the same amount and just keep focusing on our productivity and improving that at this stage. We really need to see some market movement in both wool and the meat still before we can change anything.
And Simon?
Tricky one in the future. We certainly wouldn't be reducing our livestock numbers, and I may well increase the sheep numbers as we get access to more renovated blue gum country. So there's a fair bit of upside for us. I guess the key is that the returns from the sheep enterprise have to remain competitive with the rest of the farm, and I get that's the big question. I mean, as we subsurface drain and surface drain and deep rip and do more of the intensive land inputs on the high rainfall country, it's more and more important that the returns from the sheep enterprise are competitive. So we'll see how that pans out.
Awesome. All right. So this we're going to start on our submitted questions. So the first is around shearing. So we've got. How do you manage the economics and get good results with contractor shearers and shed staff? And I'm going to combine the two questions together. And what is your shearing program/plan? When or what age do you shearing lambs, hoggets use, and why do you do it this way? We'll start with you, Jason.
Yeah, I'm cutting the first in line, aren't I, all the time? Look, we're very fortunate. We do have a very good local shearing contractor. The prices are increasing a little bit, but I know that we're probably come in a lot lower than a lot of other people, and we've never had big problems getting our sheep shorn, so that's never not been an issue for us at this point. Our shearing program, we are summertime shearers or autumn shearers. We shear prior to lambing, or lambing is in July, during July, but we just try and get our shearing out the way before our sowing program starts and any other livestock husbandry programs like dipping or backlining or preg testing and things. We run our weather lambs through as weaners, so our weaners get shorn and they're probably, what's that, six to seven months of age, and then our weather lambs can get finished in a feedlot, so they've got, you know, the short wool on them and a high growth period after their shearing. So that's what we're doing, yeah. We're very fortunate to have had a good, reliable contractor, though, yeah. Yep.
Hey.
Yeah, pretty similar. You were a bit blessed with a good contractor, and he has a good crew. We have moved to January shearing. I'm trying to shear prior to mating, and we shear everything then, just trying to, well, it's trying to get it all done in one hit, you know, if there's any troubles with lice or whatever, it seems to, the one shearing seems to help with that. Yeah, and then they get crut. We've been crutching at mulesing. I think I may move crutching to just prior to lambing. It is a pretty hectic time trying to crutch and mules at the same time, but that's how we're doing it. But I do think the contractors are the key to the outfit. Anyone with the crook contractors or having a rough time of it, they generally go to the shedding breeds or get out of the industry. So I think it is pretty important to support the good guys and find them, yeah. So that's that.
Claire? So we shear early January. We try and have the aim that we're finished before Australia Day. It just means that all the rams are out, all the ewes have a couple of weeks before rams go out on time. Then does mean that we go straight from harvest into shearing, which is a bit of a problem, but then it means we have February to do whatever we want to do without anyone coming on and off the farm. So everything gets shorn in January. So we try and have an aim to have as least amount of crossbred lambs to be shorn, which the shearers don't love, but I guess that's, I think we feel that as soon as we shear a crossbred lamb, then we've lost a bit of money. They do shear all our merino lambs, so they're only just hitting 6 months at that stage, but so we do have to be a bit careful there, but they still seem to come out really well. We've had the same shearing contractor for it's changed hands, but we've been in the same team for a very long time. I really do feel like that you do need to listen to them a little bit and know what's working and what's not. I know a few years ago we started putting sprinklers on the sheds and how much that just boosted the morale in the shed was pretty amazing. And we hit a week of 40 degrees, which has never happened down us, and they shore right through that week, which was pretty amazing. And the other thing that actually just happened today is we've moved all our rams are now getting shorn through a ram buster, which is a machine operation. So no ram is getting drugged now on our farm, which is great. And just so much less stressful. So, not having to ask a shearer to shear the rams is feeling really good.
Thanks, Claire. Simon?
Thanks, Tiff. We're 12 months, we shear once a year, so 12 months worth of wool. Spring shearing, everything gets shorn in September, October, November. With sort of, you know, we have to get 55 to 60,000 sheep through the shed in those 3 months. So the trick for us is to be running several sheds, always have sheds full when there's wet weather coming. Make the most of your good weather for shearing. And obviously, you know, I think maybe the question was sort of related to cost of shearing, and it is really hard to control the costs. You know, it's around $12 for most people now, the full cost of shearing a sheep. So It is really, it's a big proportion of, you know, the cost of the sheep enterprise. So I don't know what the answer is. I know our shearers are getting $4.50 a head instead of what I think the award might be $3.30. So maybe there's something there that we can look into. You know, maybe the AWI shearing alternatives are the way that we're going to have to go, because I think at $12 for shearing a sheep, which might be producing $50 or $60 worth of wool, is probably too high a proportion of the total income. But, you know, it's a challenge, and I don't think there's any answer yet.
Thank you. I'm going to direct a few questions at people specifically. Jason, again, we'll start with you this one. I want to talk about your containment feeding, how you got into that, and if anyone wanted to start out, what advice if you were to do it again?
Okay. So we started, well, we were feedlotting and finishing weather lambs. For a few years, probably about 10 years or so. And then we started moving our ewe weaners into our feedlot over the late autumn period, when there was very, very little value in the stubbles. And we were just finding our stubbles were just getting a little bit too vulnerable if we had a bit of a marginal start or a later start. And so we just put our ewe weaners into, well, we had lick feeders at that stage, and we were trying to get them off the paddock and keep them moving forward at a difficult time of the year. Then they started doing really well in that situation, and back then that was probably about 10 years ago, I guess. Yeah, it would have been 10 years ago. And we were at that stage, we didn't have any, we were a pure merino operation, and we'd have a off draft every year, a surplus draft of ewes. And we quite often found that they would come out of that situation, and the tail end would be in quite good nick, and we'd be able to turn them all off as to slaughter rather than just putting them through the yards. And we were getting quite a premium then when ewes were selling in the yards for probably to other growers for $60, $70. We were selling ewes in that August, July, August period when there was a shortage, getting, I think the best price we got probably 10 years ago was around about $120, $130, which was pretty good premium at the time, and certainly made it worthwhile doing that. And then we probably by necessity about 6 years ago, we had a very poor start to the season, and it was April and it was very dry and there was no rain in sight, and we actually elected to, rather than go seeding to and hope to, we just decided that we'd start fencing off a few areas around dams and things and putting ewes in those areas with lick feeders. And I think at our peak for us, we probably had with weaners in the feedlot and things like that, we probably had about, I must had about 7,000 or 8,000, 9,000 sheep in confinement around the farm, scattered around the place and in our feedlot, which seemed a bit daunting. And then it was, we were probably getting towards late May and we still hadn't received any rain at all, any meaningful rain. We were getting some strong winds, and we got to the point of lambing, and we thought we'd take a bit of a risk. There was nothing out in the paddock at all, and we thought they're only going to go out in the paddock and walk around and walk any condition off and bare paddocks out. So we actually lambed in confinement that year, which was pretty daunting. But we marked... for ewes mated to lambs born that year, we marked 95% lambs, which was a really good outcome. It was pretty stressful and we went through a lot of grain, but we would have done the same thing if they were out in the paddock. And then after lamb marking, we still had no feed. And I think we'd had about, when we marked lambs, about mid-July. Ewes were in good nick considering, and lambs were doing well, also, you know, considering the situation. And after marking, we decided to put them back in their pens again. And I think in August that year, we started getting a bit of rain. And when it came to weaning time towards the end of August, we actually did have some pasture growth and pastures that had been germinated and were just really doing nothing through that June, July period. They really started to grow away finally. And after weaning, we were able to wean lambs onto good pastures and turn ewes out onto some decent quality pastures. And then I think September was okay for us as well. And so that's what we've been doing with our confinement feeding. And then since then, we've built dedicated pens, which we plan to expand on. And that's been really good. We've enjoyed doing that, the benefits of it. And while we haven't had to lamb in confinement again since then, our efficiency for feeding and things over that autumn and early winter period while we're pastures are hopefully growing and getting away, and that's been really beneficial for us. And ewes coming out of these pens and in really good condition onto good quality pastures. So that's what our main aim with confinement is now. And we just want to really make it as efficient as we can to feed those, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 ewes in that late autumn and into the early winter period.
No, thank you. Now I'm going to throw this out to the rest of the panel because I think this is a good segue into confinement feeding. Does anyone, I know Claire, I believe I'm throwing you on the spot here. You do a little bit as well and then we can, I would love to hear what everyone else has to say.
So we've confinement fed since 2017. Pretty much that first year it had rained and we'd had a really good clover germination in the seeder it started, and I'd been moving the sheep in front of the air seeder, and then we realised that we wanted to keep going because we still had moisture, but if we put them out onto the pasture, they were just going to demolish the pasture paddocks very quickly. So I think I put 4,000 sheep out on 15 hectares and just fed them in that paddock until early June, and then we were off. And then the following year was probably the bad year Jason was talking about. It wasn't as bad in our area, but it was still, we managed to put all the sheep in, hold them in. I think we'd made 4 or 5 pens by that stage, and just slowly feed them. And they were the only paddocks that blew really that year, which was pretty amazing. And now we have 6 pens, up to 10 hectares. We stock according to whatever we've got. We still feed on the ground, and then we just try and let ewes out 3 weeks before lambing, or 1 to 3 weeks before lambing, depending how they go. Our biggest thing is how much it helps the cropping side of things. Being able to get those double knocks down has saved us a lot of money with inter herbicides, not having to use them. And just management easement. I think one person's job is 3 hours, if not that, less a day, where before it was nearly 6 hours chasing sheep around in front of air seeders and that sort of thing. So, that's why we do it.
I'll just throw a question back to you, Jason, there. Was there any feed adjustment for the confinement fed ewes this season, given prices and scarcity?
No, we didn't adjust our feeding program. We always try and have the thought process that if you try and cut back on something, or it'll cost you in the long run somewhere along the line. So we just fed a mixture of our grain, same as other years. And we always tried, like I say, try and keep in the back of our mind that we need to have a product to sell. If the worst comes along for the season, we still need saleable products. And as it is at the moment with the livestock industry, we need to have stock in good condition most of the time in case we need to want to sell them, quickly.
Simon,
I was just going to add, I mean, we do a lot of confinement feeding as well, and I think a lot of people are very much like Jason. So, but I mean, I think the other thing is to mention that the headers, you know, the headers are so good these days. We really have very little harvest loss. So wheat stubbles, barley stubbles don't have the capacity to carry sheep like they did 10 or 15 years ago. And, you know, I guess we also used to let a few summer weeds go because it was important for the sheep, but that's no longer the case. So it really is a much shorter period of value in the summer for the stock. So I think the confinement feeding is just has to become part of everyone's sheep operations and, you know, and the animal health outcomes of feeding in pens and having the ewes in really good order before lambing, you know, is just essential now.
Awesome. The next question I've got someone submitted in, and I think we touched on it a little bit, is sheep handling equipment. Has anyone on the panel, so Claire, you've just said you've tried something new with your rams, anyone invested into sheep handling equipment? What are the benefits you're seeing? Why? What brand? You know, I'll throw it out to, does any of you, I don't know, we'll go back to, we'll start with Claire while the rest of you think, and then I can go around the circle.
Yeah, so we have quite a mixture. We have a Draft and Draft, a Gallagher weigher, and a Peak Hill sheep handler. The drafter, the weigher, and the peak handler broke. They're both 10 years old now last year. So we bought in another brand that was supposed to do all three of those products in one. And I think we did 300 sheep in it and put it back outside the yards and said, no, thank you. So we do, we just, yeah, trial and error. I think all those machines we borrowed neighbours before we went and purchased them. And then we've made little adjustments along the way. And then obviously we've been using the Ram Buster the last few days to not only just shear the white Suffolk rams that hit this one is actually also shearing all the Merino rams, which is just taking so much, effort away from the job. Hopefully the guy that's doing it's not listening because it's probably a little bit hard. I don't know. Is that enough information?
Yeah, we'll see what other questions you get about it. did anyone else have anything to add for I will go to Pete and it's Pete, get ready. But Simon, you took yourself off mute. Do you have anything to add?
We use a Tapari auto weigh draft in the feedlot. I think that makes a huge difference. You can weigh 600 an hour and auto draft 600 an hour. That sort of things make life a lot easier on the staff. And like Claire, we've been using the Ram Cradle for the last few years. Taking the rams out of the shearing shed is a real win, and you will never see rams better shorn than they are through the Ram Shearing Cradle. Even though it is about $20 a head, it's really worth it. Other than that, you know, I'm still a big believer in a big race and three or four people drenching and a couple of good dogs and smashing out a couple of thousand an hour and getting the job done. Like good people, good staff, good labour makes a huge difference.
Pete, and I want to lead into your shearing shed, your new shearing shed. I believe you've just done some shearing too. So I want you to tell us about your new shed and now that you've done shearing in it, what you'd change, what you keep the same after you've spoken about your equipment.
Oh, right. With the equipment, we're pretty basic. We've just got a couple of Dendarrigan sheep handlers. Find them pretty good for drenching and doing whatever we need. They're pretty basic and pretty bulletproof. And we use the Breed Elite weighing system and drafter. I've just found, I found they're quite a good crew to deal with. They look after all your data, and if you have any problems, you just give them a ring and they can sort it out. With the shearing shed, yeah, no, yeah, it's come up pretty well. Well, very nicely. It's Ausband built the shed, and then Ag, is it Commander Ag or Ag Commander? They've done the fit out. We've ended up with a 5-stand raised board, and it's a circular year board. And yeah, no, it's really good, and the staff and the shearers like it. Yeah, but yeah, it's a little bit like all our farming equipment and that. The shearing sheds and that, we're not still using the harvesters we were using in the 60s and 70s and the tractors. So yeah, it was a big investment, but yeah. And I suppose if we go out of stock, we can gut it and turn it into a machinery shed, but that's not the option at the moment. So, but I, having had done it and thought about doing it for 20 years, I wished we'd probably done it 20 years ago. But, yeah, it has really, really helped. And the shearers love coming. They like it, you know. And some of the facilities they have to work in are pretty tough, so it ticks a few boxes. Yeah, so yeah, glad we did it. That it? I don't have to say any more.
I'll let you off for now. Jason, did you have anything to add?
No, we don't have any sheep handlers, but I agree with Simon. We've got large handling races. We can fit sort of 120, 150 sheep in a double drench race. A couple of good sheep dogs and a couple of good people there. Yeah, you can knock out some sheep pretty quickly. And the key is probably having two. And if you've got a whole heap of sheep work to do, get a third person in just to push sheep around the yards and help out. And we just try and get our stock work done as quickly as we can. Yeah, and so yeah, large handling races are that's how we still do all our stock work. Yeah, yep.
How do you guys go for staff, like stock people? We'll start with you, Jason. Is it, you know, we'll go into, I think this is our next question to be the biggest challenges around your enterprise, but how do you go, for staff?
Yeah, we've been pretty fortunate. We've probably over the last probably 15 years, I try and have one full-time person who's more a stock-oriented person. And I'm probably a little bit more, or have been a little bit more stock oriented. I'm probably getting towards the end, you know, I'm 50 now. So, but I like to try and keep jumping around the yards and try and keep fit. I think it's a good way to keep fit and keep a bit active as well, of course. And I prefer to work outside. So I have been pretty lucky to have, you know, when one person's left for the livestock, we've managed to recruit someone who's been more a stock-oriented person and yeah, we've been lucky there, I guess, yeah. Yep.
And I suppose I'll go across to you, Simon, next on this topic. And to tack on to the end of that question about staff, for a lot of growers in regards to hiring a sheep person, they're on the borderline, should I, shouldn't I, particularly with the uncertainty around prices. Where do you see the value in adding that additional person if you're hiring a stock person?
Well, I guess that scenario is a bit hard for me to answer, but I mean I've got 7 or 8 on the stock team, full-time livestock guys, and they really enjoy their work. They enjoy working with dogs, they enjoy working in a team, the key I think is always to give them plenty of scope, like give them opportunities to manage if that's what they want to do, manage other people if that's what they want to do, manage properties if that's what they want to do, and just make a really good team environment, find people who like working together. And as to whether you add an extra one, I mean, for me, when I find good people, I try and grab them and add them into the team, and there's, you know, they'll find a fit and you know, they'll prove their worth. So, you know, I think, like Jason said, once you get to 50, you probably should slow down a bit, but we don't tend to. But, you know, if it's a matter of getting one to make life easier, I'd say grab them and make the most of them.
How do you talk about team environment? What's your tips for other growers, I think, and particularly those who might not be at the point where they're hiring that many staff, but even two or three or even just over harvest, how do you create that good team environment, or what's your tips and tricks around managing staff?
Yeah, that is tricky. I mean, like I said before, if you can give people, find them a role and give them a purpose, and let them have input and let them make decisions on how the jobs are done. So don't micromanage. You know, good people will find a way of doing it. Might not be your way, but they'll get the job done. I think that's important. And, you know, you've got to find the right people too. So people who like the job, who like working hard, understand what it's about. And, you know, that's not easy. So you will go through people. I mean, we're fortunate that people who are not fitted on the livestock side will find a role for them on another part of the farm, you know. So, you know, it's not so bad. But, yeah, it's something you learn over time, I think, managing people and picking the right people.
Yeah, Pete or Claire, do you guys have anything else to add? No, well, I'll direct our next question. We'll talk about family farming. If you don't necessarily have that bigger business model, but a smaller business model, it's a tricky one. And what makes family farming unique? Does anyone have any sort of advice around that? Does anyone sit down and have that morning meeting every single Monday to address roles or anything around just family farming with your family? Or how do you even farm? Well, actually, I might direct this to Claire because you farm with your partner, actually. How do you guys manage it?
Yeah, so we're two sisters are home on the farm and my dad, and then we have a part-time worker as well. So we do a toolbox meeting Thursday nights. We try to. And if that hasn't worked, we have a WhatsApp group that everyone writes what they're doing during the week. So then we can work where everyone needs to go, and also make sure that all the kids are going to the right things. Yeah, don't know. We still try to make those things, and we're trying to have lots of dinners or breakfasts together. It's a funny one.
It is, and I think it's we can't underestimate how complicated it is, I think, when it comes to businesses. Now, does anyone have anything else to add before I completely change the subject?
I think, Tiff, like Claire was saying, communication. Like if you're farming with your family, you have to communicate. Everyone needs to know what's going on. If you can separate roles on the farm so people have independence, both in management and financially, that certainly helps. And you just have to, you know, trust each other and not worry about the little things, you know. Like if you're all heading in the same goal, you know, you'll get there as a team a lot quicker than on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, what adaption have any of you used of new pasture varieties? We have such as Seradella, Barcerula, or legume crops. Who wants to start? I nominate Pete.
I've had a go at most of those. Just trying to find the holy grail of something that you can that will set seed and you can crop a paddock for five or 3 or 4 years and come back to it. But Bicerula does seem quite a good one for that, but it has had its issues. It's very hard to get the right the inoculum to take. When you do have success with it, it's phenomenal. The photo there's a word for it when their ears get all sunburnt and that can be a bit nasty. Of all the pastures, I found the subs still to be pretty handy because you can graze them quite hard early. A lot of those other ones you don't want to take too much leaf off them early because they, that's where all their production comes from. And the subs, you can graze earlier and then you can, target your rye grasses and your other grasses. But, I find the and the Ceradellas, they're fantastic on the lighter soil types. So there does seem to be pastures for the different soil types, but in our neck of the woods with a lot of York gum country, I keep trying the other guys and coming back to the subs. Though Bice Ruler has been pretty handy, though it does not like waterlogging, which, yeah, it can really nail it if you get one of those wet years. But that's about all I've got on that one.
Yeah, we'll jump across to Jason.
We try a fair few passes over the years. We're quite fond of the Ceradellas, the yellow Ceradellas, the hard-seeded Ceradella. Clover in our system probably faded out about 15 years ago, I reckon. We get a lot of that red clover virus, and if the clover can have a stress point during the season, maybe a dry spell for a month or something like that, then our clover just seems to go red, and in the springtime the production from it is just bloody awful. So we really haven't bothered with that for probably quite some time. Yeah, yellow Ceradellas are doing quite well in paddocks that are in rotation. We might be sort of cropping them leaving them in pasture for two years out of 5 or 6 years, and they're returning quite strongly. I think the key for that is probably we would put a paddock to sell it to pasture, get a good seed set the first year, crop it this following year, and then ensure a good strong seed set again in that third year pasture seed set. Our permanent pasture paddocks, I think they're getting better as they're getting permanent pasture. It's only Wimmera ryegrass in there, but with non-wetting soils or marginal starts, we're seeing that the old press wheel furrows and things when we often have a break to the season, and then we have a dry spell for a few weeks in between our press wheel furrows. Those areas of pasture would fade out or fade away, and we could be losing up to 50% of our pasture and paddocks. Good healthy stuff in old crop rows and in between very little. So we're quite happy just leaving permanent pastures as permanent pastures. And we have grown a little bit of vetch too, so we probably will try a bit more of that as the time goes on. Yeah, or vetch and oat mix or something like that. Yeah.
There is a question there. Have any of you found some success with lucerne or vetch mixes? Claire, no. That's, and do you have anything else to add to that, Simon? Back to Jason.
No, we haven't had a lucerne and vetch mix, but we do grow a bit of lucerne. Persistence is a problem for us on the coast on gravel soils. It does well on the clay country and probably on the deep sands, but in the gravel it seems to fade out. And it grows a lot better when it's on its own. The production out of lucerne is much better if it's a standalone lucerne stand. And when it's in with grasses and things, it will fade out a lot quicker, or another pasture variety. Yeah, we found anyway in our situation.
Do you have anything to add to that, Simon?
Our traditionally our pastures are all sub clover based, but we've had a reasonable amount of trouble with the high estrogen clovers, so we're now. Really focus on the ryegrasses. So a lot of tetraploid ryegrass, a lot of our countries in a canola wheat pasture rotation, and the pasture phase is a tetraploid ryegrass, either with a vetch or a Blancer clover or a Ceradella like Margarita in the sandier soils. So I think the you know, your tetraploid ryegrass is your most high production pasture species. Animal performance on them is really good. So I think they're really underutilised in Western Australia.
While we've got you, Simon, there's a question here directed at you. How and why? I think we touched on it a little bit earlier, but, you know, how do you and why do you fit the sheep into such a large cropping enterprise?
Well, that like I just said before, the rotation is really important. So the canola wheat pasture rotation is really robust on the coastal strip. Gives you really good weed control options. The pasture phase is the nitrogen fixing phase. So, or under a ryegrass, it's still an increase in organic carbon levels of 1% in 1 year. It's pretty amazing stuff. So, you know, to have a profitable pasture phase is important on a lot of our country, and that's why the sheep work really well.
Yeah. Now, what I'm going to do, we've hit the 1 hour mark, so I'm going to throw some buzzwords out and I'll just get you to rotate through EIDs, who's using them, who started out, what are you going to use them for? Claire, we'll start with you.
Yeah, we've been using them.
That's also okay. Like, what's your plan around them?
Yeah, so all our ewes have been marked with them for the last 4 or 5 years. I could just see that it was going to come in. So, and we had had ewes that were getting up to 3 tags in their ears. Don't know why, just were. So we thought we'd just go EID and just start working with it so that when it did come in, it wasn't a huge change, which I'm kind of glad we did because we've just kept rolling with it. We've already got the technology. And we can start using it. We record a fair bit on it and we're starting to draft randomly with it. Probably not using it as much as we should, but the cost of labour to collect the data is outweighing the benefits at the moment.
What's your long-term plan, do you think, with the cost of the, like, with that? Do you see that utilising more of the data later on or just seeing where it goes?
Yeah, obviously if it's there, we'll use it, but it's just waiting to see if it is there, really.
Yep. Jason?
No, we don't use – we are putting our EIDs in our ewe weaners the last few years or ewe lambs, but, yeah, we're not using any data or collecting any data, so –
What have you found so far? Any tips? As like, you know, starting off, I know many are saying like certain tags say better, less getting caught on the marking cradle. Anything you've found just starting out that, you know, for anyone else you wish you'd known?
No tips at all. I've found a tag and I haven't looked around to be quite honest. They're like any tags. They do fall out, tear out. They're just like any other tag. So, yeah, probably a bit of a bugbear that I'll have with them, I suppose, is that we put some lambs on a truck the other day. So, you know, we were putting EID. Next year we'll be putting EID tags into those lambs and at 16 to 18, 20 weeks they'll be going onto a truck and they'll just, yeah, get chucked in the bin, those tags, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah. Seems a bit of a waste. Yeah, anyway. But yeah, so no, we're not collecting any data or using any data or anything at this stage. But yep. That'll come. We don't have a handler or anything either. So, you know, maybe if we end up with a handler with a auto drafter on it, then that'll be something we'll look at then. Probably, yeah.
Simon.
Yeah. Look, I see a little bit of value in the tags for our feedlot. Tiff, you know, trade lambs coming in, if they, you know, they'll be tagged, so that'll save us a job putting a pink tag in and we'll be able to get some weight gain data on them. So there is some value in the system, but generally for our whole enterprise, I reckon it's a real, it's just a cost. I have no intention of using the data on the ewes. I don't see how I'm going to get value out of that money I spend on tags. I see half the tags falling out by the time the ewes go cast for age, so they'll have to be re-tagged, I guess. It really will just be an expense for our operation with limited value. So, you know, I'm going to wait until the last minute before I tag anything. So, which is, you know, if there's value in something, I'm all for it, but I can't see the value there.
Hey.
We started on purple tags and went to this breed elite drafting machine. Keep birth weight, not birth weights, weaning weights, and we can identify whether it was from a twinning mob or a single. So we're probably like early days of yield mapping and that. We had a lot of data there, but we didn't know what to do with it. I think maybe monitoring weight gains or something may be handy. I haven't been that disappointed with them, but we haven't been doing any of our male stock or crossbred lambs, which that'll change next year when it becomes mandatory. But chicken and egg stuff. I find them good for identifying age groups and running them through the drafter and that. With your cull ewes, we use for our crossbreds. We don't have to, like Claire said, we haven't got all the extra tags. And I suppose when they turn up at the sale yards or something, they look a bit raggled. At least these ones are just turning up with one tag. So I do see a bit of value in them. We'll have to see how we go. Yeah,
and I'll just throw these questions out if anyone wants to answer them. I've got a question here that's been texted in. Drenching program, does anyone drench at a certain time, the same time every year, or do you utilise worm egg counts to make a decision? Does anyone want to answer that? Claire, you look excited.
Yeah, everything's worm egg counted. Probably a pre-lamb is the only time, but even that's always checked as well, just to make sure that we haven't had a blowout.
Does anyone else have anything to add?
We like Claire, we do a lot of worm egg counting these days. We'll do a worm egg count shortly. And we find probably last year was the first year for a very, very long time that we've had to drench ewes prior to them going on to stubbles. And but then when we did an egg count in April, we found that we didn't need to do a pre-lamb drench either. So we'll do worm egg counts and on our older ewes and drench accordingly. Yeah.
Simon, do you have anything to add?
We do. We always pre-lamb, always doing a pre-lambing drench, and always doing a barber's poleworm drench out of the shearing shed. So they are our two standard drenches. And then, worm egg counts on lambs are a good thing as well, just to keep an eye on what's happening. And drenching onto stubbles, if you need to, which often we do. With a lot of livestock, you have to be careful you don't get caught out. So I'd rather drench than not quite often.
The next pain relief, has anyone seen benefits since starting to use pain relief? Does anyone want to talk on that point?
Oh, I can. Think it doesn't do a too bad a job. The only thing I'll say about it, it's a little bit like going to the dentist and getting your jab after you've had your tooth pulled. But I really think they do perform pretty well after they've had it. And I will continue to use it. I think it's beneficial.
Seeing benefits there. Anyone else have anything to comment on that? Cool.
We use trisulfonate lamb marking. I think it's important that everyone does use some sort of pain relief. And you do get a better result mothering up. And and all the rest of it. So it's another expense on the cradle, but it's I think it's money well spent, and it's a good look for the industry.
Yeah, we're getting lots of thumbs up from the other panel members and nods. So I think everyone, so yeah, it's safe to say everyone's using pain relief and everyone's seeing benefits. Yeah, to their business. No, awesome. Now what I'll do is go away around key points, key takeaways, what you want other sheep producers to know as we wrap up, and anything else you think you want to share. Claire, you're below me as the Zoom looks, so we'll start with you. Key points you have, I think, that you want to share.
I don't know. I do think, like, the wool and meat industry has been around for so long, and it would be really a shame if it doesn't bounce back. But it really does need a lot more movement to make it competitive again with the other cropping enterprises. But in saying that, it's so nice to have that diversity into sheep and having the wool and meat production. It's definitely a benefit in your business. I don't know, is that what you were wanting?
Absolutely, yeah. And do you know, like, benefit in your business how? Like, obviously it's been tough this last couple of years, like, financially, but, you know, that's always going to be part of your business model, having that diversity?
Yeah, well, I think you need diversity in businesses, especially if they're getting, as they're getting bigger. And they are a lot less reliant on the environment. Like, you look at the drought that we've just sort of been through, I guess. Like, it didn't rain for 8 months where we were, so I'm sure other people would call that a drought. And we still were able to feed sheep and get them through where there was no way you could have grown a crop in that time. So, yeah, I guess that's the point.
Hey.
Yeah, no. I'll forget the question now. Sorry.
You're right. Key points you think about your sheep enterprise? Any tips, tricks, or just, you know, something you want to just get out there to the industry, I suppose, or to any other growers?
I think do it yourself. Try not to have try and keep away from government as far as you can, because whenever they get involved, it seems to get a bit messy. I think try and use whatever's the new stuff coming out, though a lot of the livestock stuff has been done for years and years, and a lot of the times we just don't actually access how much information is there. But, you know, EBVs and stuff like that, I think, you know, all need to be looked at. And, I think open your mind you can't keep doing it the way we're doing it. Just keep slowly evolving. And, I think there is a future there for it, but only be in it if you want to. If the guys that don't want to be in it, I don't see there's a need for them to be in it, because they can be quite aggravating animals, but I quite enjoy them. So, that's all I've got to say on it.
Awesome. Jason?
Yeah, probably like Peter said, if you're not happy with the way things are going, change something. You know, don't expect a different outcome if you keep doing the same thing. And, you know, whether that's upgrading a few pastures, just give it a crack, and, you've got nothing to lose, really. Nothing will change unless something changes. That's one of our farming mottos, yeah. So is anything else? That's about it, I think, from me.
Love it, Simon.
I guess just, like, it's really important to enjoy what you do and be proud of what we do. And, it's a really good industry we are in, and, you know, I think it's important that we encourage the next generation to get involved. There's some, you know, some really good progress that the young cropping guys have really enjoyed. That's, you know, that's not far away for the livestock industry. You know, we're already virtual fencing. You know, there's camera weighing. There's all sorts of things coming up for us. So, you know, I think there's, it's a good industry for the next generation. We've just got to make sure it's there for them and encourage them to get involved.
Thank you. Now, Bolte, Stephen, I'm going to throw to you. Did you want to throw anything in before we wrap up? My who hasn't done much co-emceeing.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thanks, Tiff. Look, I think for everyone listening tonight, it's been, you know, a fantastic mix within the panel, the different areas that you all operate throughout the state is, you know, gives... You know, there's some different challenges in different areas, but I think the common theme in there has tonight's been certainly, you know, implementation of new technology or implementation of new strategy to your businesses, which have helped with that, you know, to make them more robust and resilient with the challenges in front of you and, you know, confinement feeding, different pasture species. I think the other key one is that communication, whether it's around, you know, the shearing or with staff, you know, even within your own family business, you know, communication is one of those key areas. And I think, you know, we had a webinar a couple of weeks ago with Darren Spencer from the president of the Shearing Association. And obviously that's one of those, you know, key themes that, you know, as an industry, we've got to make sure that we continue to communicate really well with that shearing industry, with our shearers, contractors, to make sure that, you know, we're getting the best outcome in one of those challenging times, you know, but should be one of the most rewarding times for us as producers when we're harvesting that wool. So I will say, you know, that pain management, certainly a big key area as well that, you know, I think for industry we need to continue to strive for as many people to be implementing pain management, whether it's the trisulfan or whether it's buccalgesic, making sure as an industry we're continuing to move forward, improving all of our animal welfare standards. But I just finish up by just Woolpole closed for voting for Woolpole for All Growers, making sure that 1st November that everyone who wants to participate in Woolpole to get their votes in by that 1st of November, and Friday, 15th of November, will be the online AGM for AWI. So if you've got time to jump online and view the AGM, be you know, it's always great to hear from our company, from AWI, what changes have been put in place and what direction the board and company are heading in. So appreciate everyone for their time tonight. And, yeah, thanks for that, Tiff.
Amazing. Thank you guys so much again for joining us. I know that was really great and we're getting lots of text messages to say how interesting it was. So, no, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Good work.
Amazing.